Good morning. How well do you know just how your local candidates compare? Understanding the differences is easier with an online game. Kano Hawaii's Nicole Brody walks us through it. Meanwhile, development in Kaka'ako continues. As the area becomes more urbanized, can it convey a deep sense of place? Sig Zane says yes, and we'll hear why later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Two different approaches to history this morning. One is filmmaker Robin Lung's documentary, Finding Kukan, about a long-lost Second World War film. And the other is a youth opera that tells Hawaiian history through the watchful eyes of Auli'i, the last menehune of Nu'uanu Valley.
It's a Monday, October 24th, and that's The Conversation, coming up after this news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris. A little quiet around here.
Yes, it is. Very quiet. No donuts either.
So I hear some lament. That's because our fall fun drive wound up on Friday night.
Yeah.
And now we are moving off into the future that we're all creating together.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the very near future. Now, 2 weeks from tomorrow, well, you know that it's election day. And if you're registered to vote and haven't already walked or sent in your ballot, Kana Hawaii and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs wants you to spend a little time on their website. The community group recently launched a game to help voters separate what they think they know about local candidates from what candidates have actually said about issues. You get to choose the answers that you like, and they aren't attached to the candidate who gave them unless you select that part. And at the end, the game will show you your preference. Now, Nicole Brody is the executive director of Kano Hawaii. She's here with all the details. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. Nice to see that you did this again, because there were a lot of people who, when we talked to them the first time around, were really surprised at what happened when they just saw answers side by side and were allowed to pick and choose, and then found that maybe they had very different candidates who represented their perspective. How did you refine the game this time around?
So just so everyone's clear, the idea is we anonymize the candidates' responses so that people are not voting based on party or face or names, like I think most times people do. So it's really just their answers to some questions. This time we had fewer questions. We kept the questions short. We wanted to make it as engaging as possible. We found this election that it's really hard to get people to engage around the elections. My assumption is because they've been going on for so long, and it just feels like that's all that's being talked about. I think people are just kind of sick of it, particularly the presidential race. And we feel like that's unfortunately drowning out the local elections. And so our game is every single race in Hawaii except the presidential, to kind of bring it back to local issues.
And candidates, not constitutional questions, not charter
right.
questions, just the candidates and who says what and whether or not that syncs with a particular voter's perspective.
Yeah, exactly. And so we have fewer questions, they're shorter, and we wanted to make them a little different. Again, we feel like people are sort of disengaging from the election, and so we wanted to make it relevant to millennials, another group that we feel like isn't engaging quite as much. And also just sort of surprising and interesting questions. Like we ask people or candidates like what their favorite local snack is or local food.
There would some who might say, well, that trivializes some of this too. Obviously trying to humanize a candidate and get some insight through a choice that might be made. But the real questions that you ask people where they're really, where the candidates are asked to make a statement about certain issues. How did those questions change when you say you made them shorter? Yeah, we noticed that they were shorter. But when you said that you also wanted to engage differently, give me an example of how that changed.
Well, I think that goes to the local snack questions or the what are three things that you've done in your own life to make Hawaii a better place. So just like you said, humanizing, personal, I think a little more interesting. I think a lot of people aren't as interested in the wonky political policy issues and conversations. And so how do we find ways to talk to our candidates and with our candidates in a way that appeals to everyone. And I mean, we're not saying, you know, you should vote based on what their local snack is, but hopefully this at least opens a door in a conversation. It's like, oh, look at this person. You know, this is a surprising answer. I'm interested by this. And hopefully they can then do some more research and look into this candidate. And there are serious questions along with those questions. And so we wanted to find that balance of how do we, you know, get to those harder-hitting questions, but also make it enjoyable and interesting for people to play, and hopefully they share that information. Because at the end of the day, there's still, it's more information, more informative than, like I said, simply a face or a party or a name.
When you talk about harder-hitting questions, which ones did you come up with, or give us an example of one that you came up with that you think is particularly germane or important that people would be looking at in a particular neighborhood? Obviously, this varies from, you know, district to district, but to be able to illustrate that sense of difference this time around?
Well, in our state races, we have some of those harder questions. We worked closely with OHA in coming up with those questions. So we have 5 open-ended questions and 3 multiple-choice questions. I think that's what it is, or maybe 4 multiple-choice. And the 4 multiple-choice relate to Native Hawaiian issues that, of course, affect everyone in the state. And then the open-ended questions are the more, like, what's the most important issue facing your district, those types of local hard-hitting questions.
What's a question that you wanted to ask that didn't make it into the game?
I don't know that I really had any. I feel like coming up with the questions was one of the hardest parts for me, because I feel like there's just so many things that I want to know, and it's hard to figure out what's the right thing to ask. You know, there's so many different issues that are important to our community. And again, we wanted to find that balance of how do we make it enjoyable for people to play? Because I think that that's sort of the most important thing. I mean, creating a game that no one uses is useless. And so we wanted to find a way that how do you make it fun for players that they want to share it with other people and say, oh, check this out. This is how I determined how to fill out my ballot.
You say that you talked about issues that are different district to district, and certainly island to island. How did you find out what was important to people? I mean, did you have focus groups? Did you knock on doors? I mean, how did you find out really what should be asked in those questions that the majority of people would want to know?
Yeah, in some cases we did. We had events. We had this little, like, penny for your thoughts type of thing. We had different jars with the different questions, and people, we gave people pennies, and they just voted with pennies, and they put their penny in the jar that had the question that they wanted asked from their candidates. So that was one of the ways. So we did ask people. We also went door to door and asked people what issues that they care about. So we were able to get some feedback from the community. The OHA questions came from OHA itself. They asked some, you know, people who have a lot of knowledge in the Hawaiian community, a lot of respect, and they came up with 3 questions. And so it was a variety of things. We asked some people who work with students and millennials to come up with some questions that would be relevant to younger folks. And so we had a few different tactics for the different races.
In the end, was there a way that you wanted to see the game move or be able to be positioned differently than it how we see it when we go online?
You mean, does it look different than what we planned?
I mean, yeah, very much so.
No, I mean, I think this is pretty much what we wanted. I think, you know, again, there's a lot of different interests to weigh, but I think we came up with something that is hopefully interesting and surprising, gets people to engage with it and share it with others.
Well, I mean, there aren't any, you know, bells or whistles or things
right,
blinking
simple.
At you. It's very simple. Some would say very static, and trying to move you to the information as opposed to, you know, just wowing you with how many things can be thrown at you in a couple of, you know, seconds.
Right. And I think that goes back to, you know, feeling like so many things are distracting from this election and from what's important in local issues, that we just wanted to take those distractions away and just keep it very simple. So it's just really the answers, and you just click a button that says, I prefer this answer over that answer. And at the end, it will tell you eventually, you know, which candidate you tend to agree with more.
And you could get a very surprising answer. Nicole Brody, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to play the game, you can find it. It's on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting the Yardbirds in two shows nightly, this Friday through Sunday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:14, and coming up, revealing a forgotten chapter of Second World War history. But first, your quiz.
This December will mark 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. For today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a national monument in Hawaii that relates to what happened after the attack. Last year, a presidential proclamation signed by President Obama established the site, the monument, in the language of the proclamation, quote, serves as a powerful reminder of the need to protect civil liberties in times of conflict and the effects of martial law on civil society. After the Pearl Harbor attack and before martial law was invoked for the territory of Hawaii, government leaders began to round up local residents suspected of disloyalty and collaboration with the Japanese Empire. At first, they were confined to local jails, but soon were interned at the U.S. Immigration Station and Sand Island Detention Camp on Oahu. On March 2, 1943, the internees were transferred to another Oahu site managed by the U.S. Army. It was the largest and longest used confinement site in Hawaii. This morning, we're looking for its name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, working to protect and manage Oahu's drinking water resources for life. Learn seven ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
The best documentary films are often detective stories, where an overlooked story from history is brought to life in rich detail. It's the kind of story Robin Leung knew she had when she learned of a Chinese woman born in Hawaii, Li Ling-ai, the uncredited producer of the Academy Award-winning documentary Kukan, filmed at great risk inside China when it was under attack by the Japanese Empire. Robin's film is about the restoration and rediscovery of a forgotten chapter in cinema history and in Second World War history. It's called Finding Kukan. It's going to be at the Hawaii International Film Festival, and Robin's with us this morning. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Chris. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. In a way, the quest for information that you undertook in making this movie became the story of the movie, it sounds like.
Yeah, it wasn't intended. I had hoped to tell a Ken Burns type of story that reveals all of the history behind the making of the film mm-hmm. and all the history behind this Chinese woman from Hawaii, Li Ling-ai. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to piece together all of that story because so much of it had been lost over time.
Yeah. So what do you do when you reach a deadlock like that?
Well, I decided that we would construct the story as a mystery and include the hunt for information mm-hmm. in the film. And so I think viewers will really have a good time because they're following the story as I found it. And we allow them to make their own guesses about different questions I had about the story. Mm-hmm. And there are some things that remain open-ended. And I think it's a movie that people will continue to talk about after they see it, because there are many theories about how it was made and different questions that occur in the film.
Well, let's talk about the movie that your movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
the movie Kukan itself. What was that?
Well, Kukan was a landmark film. First of all, it was a color film. Mm-hmm. It was shot on Kodachrome film. Kodachrome had just been invented a couple of years prior. And it was a film really about the Chinese people's struggle to maintain their life and dignity while they are being invaded and bombed by planes from the Japanese military. So it's really a positive look at the Chinese resistance to the attempted takeover of their country.
A lot of the Japanese attacks on China during the Second World War were, as in the movie, attacks on relatively defenseless positions, right?
Yes. A lot of the film, Kukan, was shot in the wartime capital of Chongqing. And that became the wartime capital because it was in the center of China, and it was mountainous, and bomb shelters could be dug into the mountains very mm-hmm. easily. And most of the population had to live in those bomb shelters for much of the war because the Chinese air strength was very poor, and they didn't have anti-aircraft capability to defend themselves from the ground.
Which made for a pretty treacherous situation for the residents of that city. And the film was shot by whom?
The film was shot by a cameraman named Ray Scott. Mm-hmm. And he was actually a Honolulu advertiser photojournalist before he met Li Ling-ai. Mm-hmm. And when he met her, he was interviewing her because she was trying to fly a plane. She was learning to fly a plane the year that Amelia Earhart crashed into the ocean. And they discovered that the Japanese military were bombing Shanghai. And that was really the start of World War II in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So Li Ling-ai goaded Ray Scott to go to China to document what was happening there. And that became the beginnings of Kukan.
Why wasn't she originally credited?
Well, Li Ling-ai is credited as a technical advisor in Kukan. And part of my journey in my own film, Finding Kukan, is to discover whether or not she deserved more credit mm-hmm. than she received.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little bit of a spoiler, but I do find out that, in fact, she did deserve a lot more credit than she got. And I think that's typical of the time period, that women were not respected and given a lot of the credit they deserved. But it's also something that continues today. And I think we see that in women's work and for equal pay.
I think if you look hard enough, you can see signs of that in contemporary society. But it sounds as if she was looking to follow in the footsteps of Amelia Earhart in the 30s, she was part of that very intrepid breed of women that emerged between the world wars in this country, yeah?
That was really what was so fun to find out about all of these women, not mm-hmm. just Li Ling-ai, who really were ahead of their time and were really great role models and inspirational women that, for the large part, I had not known about.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun to find out about these women.
What was it that made her want to send a camera to China? Had she been a journalist, a filmmaker? What was her... She just happened to meet this photographer when he did a story on her?
Well, Li Ling-ai's connection to China were very personal. Her parents were both from China. They were both physicians and mm-hmm. very politically active. And China at the time was a new republic. It had just thrown off the monarchy of the emperor.
Yeah.
And there was great hope for the future of China. And many Chinese Americans who were discriminated against in America
mm-hmm.
saw China as a great opportunity, a place to establish a foothold. And she had a sister who was working in China as a doctor, and she had lived with this sister prior. So she knew people who were in danger in China. So it was a very personal mission for her to get Americans to pay attention to what was going on there.
It's a really good example of the way an individual story can sort of send ripples outward and show the larger story contained within, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very much a documentary filmmaker story. They have a passion to tell something, and they want to get the story out there.
You can identify with that.
Yes, very much.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Chris. I hope people will come and see our movie and find out more about it.
Yeah. Robin Leung is a Hawaii filmmaker whose documentary, Finding Kukan, will be screened at the Hawaii International Film Festival Saturday, November 5th and Friday, November 11th at Dole Cannery Theaters. And you can find out more about the movie on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Many thanks to everyone who became a new and sustaining member or provided additional gifts during the fall pledge drive, and to our stellar volunteers and all those who kept us well-fed so we could focus on the business of keeping this station going for another 6 months. We are deeply grateful for your support of Hawaii Public Radio and of this show. Thank you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, last year donating to more than 600 nonprofits in Hawaii, the Pacific, and on the mainland, where its employees and their families work and live. More on Facebook or Matson.com.
Talk to your friends and neighbors about this next topic, and you won't find much common ground. And that's exactly what Civil Beat found in the latest poll about what to do about feral cats. Civil Beat's Chad Blair joins us now with a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, we've had a lot of conversations about feral cats in past. The latest one that we had, I think, was concerning the issue of toxoplasmosis, a parasitic disease that is transferred from cat poop to animals that we care about, other animals that we care about, nene geese and birds and dolphins and monk seals. But even with that happening, there are those who say that you don't put, you know, one animal ahead of another. And yet looking at this poll, it seems as if a lot of people want to do just that.
Right. I'll give the numbers in just a second. But to add to that context, you know, Nathan Eagle, our reporter, actually reported on toxoplasmosis a couple months ago. And since then, other media have come forth, including Honolulu Magazine. The Associated Press had something just last week. But, you know, there's also a new book out from Princeton University Press. And it says that nationwide, as well as around the world, cats are decimating not just monk seals and spinner dolphins, but bird species and other animals, and it's by the billions. So in this context, cats as killers, as cuddly as they may be, we did ask voters on Oahu how they felt about feral cats and what should be done. And 69% of them said, you know, culling them, that is, killing them, may be an option given the seriousness of the threat.
For a lot of people who love all animals, and especially for those cat lovers in our audience, this is
that
very...
That would be me, too.
I know, and me, too. This is tough news to hear, and yet it's asking that fundamental question. Can you put one animal ahead of another? What do you do when you have animals who are, you know, clearly overrunning an area, causing disease and issues for other animals, and by the same token, not wanting to see those animals having to be culled? Was there any more discussion about simply doing something about the cats as opposed to this is what specifically X amount of people want to see done?
Some have said, let's have more research on this. Let's try and find out exactly what's happening. Basically, there's two sides, split between scientists and animal rights experts. The animal rights experts, like the Hawaiian Humane Society, say, look, let's do trap, neuter, release, manage. Let's be compassionate to control this problem. But scientists, and they include NOAA and the Department of Land and Natural Resources, say, you know what? A more aggressive approach may be the only way, and that would be culling. But as somebody did point out, you know, it's not the cat's fault that this is happening. On the other hand, you are destroying ecosystems.
And when they say it's not the cat's fault, they're saying what? It's our fault.
Well, essentially it is. And cats are an invasive species, and we brought them here.
All right. Is there any next step to this thing in seeing what happens and what voters want done?
I expect so. I think research is definitely called for, but the fact that there were 300,000, I remember when I told that to you last time, it still kind of makes me catch my breath. 300,000 feral cats on Oahu. That is just astounding. Thousands more on the neighbor islands, and they include here on Oahu colonies from Hawaii Kai to Waianae. They are all over, and this is not something that we can just let go anymore. We have to do something about it. At least that's what's coming from the experts.
Especially when you think about there are maybe thousands more on the way, because that's yeah. what happens. All right, Chad, this is a toughie. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. If you've walked through Oahu's Kaka'ako area, you know the place looks a lot different these days. You look around, you'll see high-rise and mixed-use buildings under construction for a planned neighborhood with residential units, shops, and restaurants. The identity that's also emerging isn't happening by accident. The Ward Village project of the Howard Hughes Corporation is leaving the sense of place to Hilo artist Sig Zane. Late last week, he was in Honolulu, and we sat down to talk about the changing visual character of Kaka'ako and how he makes both peace and art through the development.
I grew up in Honolulu, and I've watched Kaka'ako change, and it's always been changing, and that's one of the things that I really like about it. But right now, the responsibility is something much greater than just what is happening in terms of development. That responsibility is really to perpetuating culture in a Kanaka perspective. And really, it is foremost honoring ancestral connections, honoring all of that culture that has been practiced for so many centuries prior to Western thought. So I think that right now, as we look at Kaka'ako, we have a opportunity to bring in icons, visual icons of the culture that speak much louder than what is happening in a sense of the concrete jungle. You know, it really takes us back to the things that are fundamental, foundational, and I think that that's where we have an opportunity here to express ourselves in a very distinct, unique, and abstract way.
What are those foundational things that perhaps we don't pay a lot of attention to, but that just seem to flow through the work that you're perpetuating in the whole Kaka'ako area?
Well, you know, when we look at Kaka'ako, we really study far beyond just the visual. We really look at a lot of the history, what it stood for in the old days, especially to the ali'i, because wherever the ali'i went, they were so akamai as to what place meant. And Kaka'ako had a lot of history, especially in a sense that it was very momona. It was very fruitful. It was a place of significance because of its placement in line with other very prominent features, especially Puawaina or Leahi. It's played an important part in the governance of place. When we look at that kind of history, you know that the value is not just because it's close to the beach or because it's in a sunny plain. There's a lot of other important places or important factors of place, and it's that history that we want to celebrate. We bring that forth in the symbolic art, especially like we've been using the ohekupala, the art that illustrates the kapa. But we use those imagery because that is how the Hawaiian express themselves. And it really works in a very contemporary manner too, yeah?
So what are some of those factors about Kaka'ako, both from history and given the modernity that you have to marry it to now, that show up in how you look at Kaka'ako, especially given what you've just said about it having been a place for the ali'i. Some say, well, we've just sort of brought in different ali'i now who can afford to be there, but who nonetheless want a sense of place.
You know, that's interesting that you say it like that. But in terms of our foundation, you know, we honor the people that have come before us. And for us, they are still there. Maybe we bring back the kalo. You know, there were lo'i there before, and that was how they sustained themselves, by planting in those wetlands. But that kalo also has a greater meaning. It was our oldest brother. You know, it also means ohana. And all of that kind of meaning we bring to that design sense. So the intent is really to bring back all of those understandings, especially of place and language and who was there. And although maybe that visual icon that people will look at might not be easily translatable to them at that first moment, but maybe after 5 years, they might get something out of it. Subliminally is sometimes a really important approach to delivering an intent. And as long as we have the intent and we place it there with that intent, we hope that meaning gets told someday. We believe in repetition. You know, culture is really a whole bunch is formed on that redundant nature. You know, like we see that often in nature, you know, like birds, how they fly. It's very repetitious. You know, you see how the waves approach the shore. It's repetitious. Same thing in Hawaiian chant. You know, it is often repeated over and over and over because we believe that that word manifests itself. So we have to put out good stuff because what we say is going to happen. Yes, the same thing with the art. It is repeated purposely so that that intent is, again, put out there over and over so that, like, for example, the meaning of that kalo, of ohana, that is a very important value that we want practiced, we want understood, we want it to be formally acknowledged and embraced, yeah, so that we put it out there over and over, yeah. We put out all these elements that are part of this honua, this specific land at Kukulua'o, because we want that to live. We want that history to still be a part of what is today.
Sig Zane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Sig Zane has more to say about how Kaka'ako is developing, and you can find that extended interview on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. When I first began teaching at UH Maui College, I was stunned to learn that some of my students, high school graduates, mind you, could not read. I couldn't wrap my mind around the idea. How could someone make it through high school and not be able to read? It really troubled me. Thankfully, Robert Watts Sr. is doing something about this issue. In 1993, he established the Kaloa Scholarship Fund so students could continue their education beyond high school. 2 years later, he and his two sons, Robert Jr. and Kendall, founded the Marjorie Waterhouse Watts Reading Enhancement Grant Kaloa School Fund. With this gift, the Watts want to help students gain a greater appreciation of reading. Robert Jr. and Kendall both live on the mainland now, but they say knowing they're helping others learn to read makes them feel closer to home, and there's no better place to make a difference. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Tonight at 5, it's the Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, sometimes women and families are the last ones to worry about their own health, yeah?
That's what we see a lot. So today we're going to be talking with an OBGYN doctor about what are some of the things that women can do to keep themselves healthy, some simple tricks and things that they may want to keep an eye on so that they understand when it's really serious and they need to make themselves the priority.
Well, what are some of those?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about things that can go on, you know, just in general, female gynecologic health. When are bladder infections too many so that there could be a sign of something going wrong? What else could be going on that would result in potentially implications further down the road? We're going to talk about HPV vaccination. We're going to talk about when do you have to continue and when can you stop things like pap smears. Really kind of give women a really good idea about what is normal, what is abnormal, and how often do they need to come in to get checked out.
There are some, it sounds as if there are some symptoms that can be warning signs or can be not as dire as they seem.
Yeah? Absolutely. And the real key is that, you know, for a lot of women, they may take care of every other member of their family. They may make sure that their kids are healthy, their husband's healthy. A lot of women are taking care of their parents as well and or their nephews and nieces, and in some cases their grandchildren. So what are some of the things that they should really keep an eye out for themselves to make sure that they don't have the consequences of some sort of dire medical problem as time goes on?
Never a good idea to neglect your own health. Yeah,
okay. You got it. We're going to talk about it today.
Thanks, Kathy. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Aloha. I'm Allison Altcroft from Manoa Valley Theater. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HIConversation.
It's Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the simply massive universe around our very small planet. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips for our report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. For this week, Stargazers, look out for Mars and Saturn in our evening skies. Now, the moon this week will be waning, meaning a return to dark skies.
And this week, speaking of the heavens, we are looking as far away as one can possibly look in the solar system and news about some clouds on the radar.
That's right. We are returning to the cold depths of the outer solar system this week and to our most beloved of dwarf planets, Pluto. Some time ago, the NASA New Horizons spacecraft visited our tiny neighbor and obtained an incredible amount of data about this frozen world. The high-resolution images showed us for the first time what the surface of Pluto was like. What New Horizons also did was to study the atmosphere, and it has now been discovered that there are clouds in the Plutonian sky.
And what does this discovery mean in terms of its significance about clouds on Pluto?
Well, we see clouds all over the solar system, but for the longest time, we used to view Pluto as nothing more than a glorified ice cube, a barren oddball of the outer solar system. What New Horizons did was reveal that Pluto is a fantastically diverse world. There are magnificent mountain ranges, frozen seas of exotic chemicals, and now clouds.
So it has an atmosphere of some kind, is what it seems like.
It does, but an incredibly thin one.
Okay. And in terms of the makeup of the clouds, any idea what they're made of?
Well, the clouds here on the Earth are made of water, but the clouds on Pluto are exotic in comparison. They are made of hydrogen cyanide, methane, and ethane. They're also very short-lived. and we think that they form during the Plutonian dawn and dusk.
And how do they know what's in the clouds? They actually measure it or just from looking at them?
Well, New Horizons was able to not only take pretty pictures with its cameras, but it was also able to take spectroscopic measurements to show us what kind of chemicals exist not only on the surface, but also in the atmosphere of Pluto.
Using a light kind of mechanism.
Absolutely.
That is such a trip. They can do something like that without actually taking a sample of the air. Amazing stuff. It's Christopher Phillips and another insightful stargazer, this one talking about Pluto. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
In today's backyard quiz, we remembered an internment site on Oahu that is being made into a national monument. It was used to confine local Japanese Americans side by side with Japanese prisoners of war during the Second World War. It was one of several Department of Justice and War Relocation Authority camps set up during the war, the only one in Hawaii. Some 400 civilian internees and 4,000 prisoners of war were held here over the course of the conflict. It consisted of 175 buildings, 14 guard towers, over 400 tents spread across 160 acres. It was a secluded location located at the bottom of a deep gulch that trapped heat and moisture. Internees referred to it as Jigoku Dani, Hell Valley, because of its miserable conditions. The language of the presidential proclamation establishing a national monument on the site reads, "The Honouliuli internment camp serves as a powerful reminder of the need to protect civil liberties in times of conflict and the effects of martial law on civil society."
Stan Ahn knew exactly what we were looking for. He called us from Honoka'a, and we'll be receiving an HPR T-shirt. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:47.
Opera will be kept alive as long as there are voices to sing it and composers and librettists willing to keep the art form fresh with new material. The Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus is supplying the willing voices and composer Herb Mahelona the original material for Auli'i, the last menehune of Nu'uanu Valley, a youth opera sung in the Hawaiian language. The chorus has a landmark performance coming up, and Malia Ka'ai Barrett, its general manager, is with us in our studio. Good morning, Malia.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here with you today.
I love the idea of a Hawaiian language opera.
Well, actually, our opera is both Hawaiian and English, so it's very attainable, but it's definitely based on a Hawaiian theme. This particular opera came out of an original story that was written by a native Hawaiian that had gone back to the university for some extra education. He was kind of a non-traditional student. He had taken some creative writing classes, and he came up with this wonderful story about a menehune who basically is separated from his family. They are running away from war, and there is an ipuka, and it's like a time portal, and it only opens every 200 years. And so the menehune are rushing to get away from imminent danger, and Auli'i, our menehune, goes looking for his best friend, and he misses his opportunity to get through the portal. He gets left behind. And so now he has a companion. He actually goes looking for his best friend, and he has a companion who then spends the next 200 years with him observing Hawaii as it changes. So it's a wonderful story about change in Hawaii through the eyes of course, you know, some say our mythical menehune creatures. And so the storyline is delightful. The music is just, it's one of those things that you can get a little earworm, you know. The melodies are delightful and beautiful. And Herb is a very gifted composer. He's composed actually for our organization 5 operas now, but he's also composed for Kamehameha School's Keaau campus. He's now actually written 3 all Hawaiian language operas. So he's quite a gifted composer, and we're just so thankful to have his body of work to present.
Opera can be a really good storytelling vehicle, can't it?
Well, it's a wonderful storytelling vehicle. And what makes our program, of course, different than, you know, if you were to go to the Hawaii Opera Theater or to the Met or to, you know, to Chicago Lyric, is that we designed our program over 25 years specifically to be performed by youth performers, which mm-hmm. means that the operas themselves are not nearly as long as grand opera. The subject matter is more appropriate for youth performers. Therefore, it's very family friendly. And so, you know, while somebody might experience some unhappiness, it's never kind of the unhappiness that you experience in adult grand opera. And our program is different. Rather, you know, because, of course, the Hawaii Opera Theater also has a touring program, but oftentimes what they're doing, or rather a residency, is that they're adapting an opera that was intentionally written for adults with adult subject matter, and then kind of the words are changed and, you know, adapted to children. So our programs are different for that reason.
Well, the actions of grand opera tend to be pretty apocalyptic, right?
Yes, lots of people dying, people being stabbed, people being poisoned. Yeah. It's all about real life, which is why we love opera.
That's right. Perhaps a little exaggerated here and there.
Yes, at times. So this story, there's definitely periods of great angst, of course, as Auli'i is watching Kamehameha come to Oahu and work to unite the Hawaiian Islands, and of course does battle against the forces of Oahu, and then it actually concludes with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So there is definitely those aspects to the story, but there's also a very, very strong message of Malama Aina and caring for our land and being connected to that which sustains us. So there's lots of wonderful teaching values that comes through this particular opera. So we're very excited. This is actually the 20th year from its composing. So we're celebrating its 20th year. And actually, this is just the third time that the Youth Opera Chorus is actually presenting this particular opera. So the students who are performing this, this is completely new material for them.
How many are there?
So in our organization, the students who will be performing are members of our core organization, which are the students that come to us weekly on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. We currently have a membership of 120 students. The primary performers will be the students that are grades 3 through 12, although we will also be having our kindergarten through second graders doing some pre-performance music. Wow. And then we will also be inviting the fifth graders of Ka'iulani Elementary School and Ka'ewai Elementary School to come and do some pre-performance as well. So it's going to be an all-youth experience. And you know, until I started working with the Youth Opera Chorus, I never fully appreciated the capacity and capability and amazing skills that youth can have. You know, oftentimes I think we don't give kids nearly enough credit, but they really are truly very gifted performers. And many of these students, especially the ones who will be singing solo roles, have been, you know, they're members of the Hawaii Opera Theater Young Artist Studio. They many of them will go on to continuing their music education at a, you know, college and then beyond into a professional capacity. Of course, we've had several alumni that have gone on to professional careers, both as composers, music teachers, and of course, opera singers. Quinn Kelsey is probably our best known current alumni, but also our very, you know, the Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus is celebrating 56 years. We've been around since 1961, and one of our very early alumni is Dean Pitchford, who is the composer of Footloose. So the Youth Opera Chorus, well, not all of our students go on to a performance career or a music career. A good number of them do, and they get their start in an organization like ours.
Well, that was one of the first questions that occurred to me, Malia, was putting very young kids into what has to be a highly disciplined environment.
Yes, definitely. And like with any organization working with children, it has its moments of challenge. But we find that our students, you know, they're with us because they love the discipline and the art of music, and music requires discipline. And so that's very much a part of what we instill in our students. And I always tell our parents, families when they join our organization that, you know, you brought your child to us because they were singing in the shower and in the car, and so you recognize that they had an interest in singing. But they will learn so many life values through being involved in a music organization such as ours, the values of discipline and hard work and teamwork and time accountability, and on top of learning languages and cultures and so many good things that, and also friendship and cooperation. This is what being a performing artist, being a participating artist, brings to someone's life. And so it's why we are so passionate about what we do.
Well, there are many, many additional benefits, aren't there?
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. Malia Ka'ai Barrett is the general manager of the Hawaii Youth Opera Chorus, which is presenting a youth opera called Auli'i, The Last Menehune of Nu'uanu Valley, Friday, November 11th at Kauaihao Church in Honolulu. And you can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, featuring violinist Ray Chen in Brooks Violin Concerto No. 1 and Holst's The Planets with Maestro Sarah Ioannidis at the Blaisdell, 4 p.m. this Sunday. More at hisymphony.org.
But then the Kanu Hawaii Candidate Game you talked about at the beginning of the show has an interesting perspective because you select your vote based on issues rather than on people. And you could be surprised by where that leads you, right?
And a lot of people are. I mean, we've heard that from several different folks, including people around these parts, who have sat down to play the game and been a little bit surprised by who they come up with at the end of it. And that's part of the whole thing, is trying to disentangle the people and the personalities from the issues and perspectives that the candidates have.
Well, we've been several decades along now. Each campaign seems to be more dominated by advertising, and the language of advertising isn't always designed to give you the straight truth, is it?
Which is why some groups, including Kanu Hawaii, certainly other groups that have asked in past, League of Women Voters and others, trying to get candidates to nail down perspectives so that people can have a way of shopping their candidates and really seeing what those issues are and how the candidates differ in their views toward meeting those issues and being able to do well by their community.
Making that informed decision.
That's the whole point. And we'll see what happens with that informed decision 2 weeks from tomorrow. Meanwhile, tomorrow we're going to be talking about the issue with the foreign fishermen hired by Hawaii's longline fleet. Advocates say that the issue is far from over. We're going to talk some of the legal issues with Larry Geller. Also, we'll check in with Neil Conan from The Farm.
And we'll hear Senator Martha Redbone's take on blues and soul.
Meanwhile, if you would like to be in touch with us, you can do that via our talkback line. Leave us your name and the city from which you're calling. Our number is 808-792-8217. Again, that's 808-792-8217.
Find past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back in the morning with you right here with more of The Conversation.